When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello there. Welcome to the review for Micro. So I decided to do a podcast only instead of the Zoom, just because I ran out of time on another one of the reviews, and this way I won't run out of time. So first off, let me address something. You're going to see the final exam section, but then there's also a section called final exam accommodations or something like that. Don't bother with the accommodation section unless your school gives you some kind of accommodation. So think like extended time or something like that. You should probably, I don't think you'll be in there. If you are, it's there, but it's not something to really worry about. Just be in the final exam section of the class. Just as a reminder, you or your proctor should take a picture of the written work and submit that to me by email, and I will grade your test once I get that and kind of finalize things for this. I think that's it. All right, so the review covers the three topics, 4, 5, and 6, and so we'll run through those here. The test is 45 multiple choice questions, and then the two short answers, FRQs, which are both 5 points. So that's kind of how the test will be structured. And you can have a basic calculator. All right, so for in four, first up is the oligopolistic oligopoly. And first off, just an oligopoly, that's a market structure where there is a small number of firms that dominate the industry. And typically those few are the largest firms, already, and they have the power, the authority to really drive the prices of the market. It's called price leadership. It could lead to some collusion where the leaders, the price leaders, could possibly kind of get together and create a situation where they set prices artificially high, but that's an illegal thing. So I'm a baseball fan, and I used to wonder, really, and I may have said this, I can't remember, in one of our sessions, but baseball, I would hear when I was a kid, like, players making millions of dollars and people being upset and ownership being upset. I'm like, well, why don't the owners, there's 30 of them, why don't they get together and they set their prices? Like, hey, a first baseman is going to make this much, a second baseman makes this much, so on and so forth. But realizing now they can't do that because that would be collusion. Monopolistic competition, that is a market structure with a lot of firms selling differentiated products. Now, they're similar products, but they are a little bit differentiated. Firms have some degree of market power due to the differentiation, but the competition is pretty fierce because it is similar products. And I know I've said this, that I like the laundry detergent as an example, just because their commercials to me are so silly, because they'll dirty up a white t-shirt and then they'll wash it with their brand and they'll wash it with the competitor's brand. And somehow theirs is always better. So that's them trying to show that differentiation. Monopoly, that's a market structure with only one seller, giving the firm complete control over the market. They have little to no competition. Typically, the government will have to be the competition. And without that, the monopolies are able to set prices above the marginal cost. And really, it's unfair to us as consumers when there is only that one seller. Let's see. Barriers to entry in an industry, specifically, typically monopolies. There are barriers to entry that make it difficult for firms. Things like high startup costs can lead to a barrier. Economies of scale, there could be legal barriers, control over the resources, getting the resources. The monopoly itself can sometimes be a barrier to entry So there are things that are going to exist that make it difficult sometimes for businesses to get into a certain industry. A natural monopoly. This occurs when economies of scale allow one firm to serve the entire market at the lowest cost. A lot of times you'll see a natural monopoly as kind of government authorized, might be the way to say it, as the government feels like, hey, that's the way to go, to have one seller instead of having a whole bunch of competition. Used to see an example of like the bus system. So just let the one bus, the city bus or the whatever, the county bus, be the people that are picking people up and not have a whole bunch of bus companies competing, because then you got all these giant buses racing around and things like that. So that would be kind of an example there. Perfectly competitive market. This is where there are many small firms selling identical products and no single firm can influence the market price. And that's the key thing to remember there. In the perfectly competitive market, you have to have it to where nobody. If me and you are selling things, I can't influence the price. You can't really influence the price. It's just going to be our product that we're selling. And then firms are price takers and have to accept the market price set by the supply and demand. And so that's one of the key concepts of the perfectly competitive market. Changes in elasticity. Remember, elasticity is going to measure the responsiveness of quantity demanded or supplied to changes in prior into price or income. So basically, you know, if cars go from $30,000 to $10,000, that's going to cause a big change in price. So that'd be pretty elastic. If cars go from $30,000 to $25,000, that'll be a nice little savings for people. I don't know that it'll cause as much change as the going down to $10,000, but that's still pretty elastic. If price goes from $30,000 to $29,000, people are just saving $1,000. That probably wouldn't be that super elastic. That'd be more inelastic, where that change in price did not cause a big change in demand or supply. But the change in elasticity can affect consumers and producers' behavior. And you know, if they're going to go out and purchase things or not, the outcomes in the market and some government policies. Cartel. And an option to cheat or not cheat an agreement. So remember, cartels, that is the conglomeration of businesses, firms, however you want to call it, that collude to restrict output and raise prices. And they kind of act like a monopoly, even though they're not really a monopoly. And they face a dilemma, the group that makes up this cartel, on whether to cheat on the agreement by producing more than agreed upon to increase profits. And so that's what you got to think about when you see this question, is what are the cartel members doing? What's going into their decision on whether they honor or don't honor? And there were some questions on the Unit 4 test about this, where people had to decide, you know, what was best. Was it best to break the agreement or was it best to cheat the agreement? Collusion effects, that occurs when firms cooperate to restrict competition and increase profits, and it can lead to higher prices, reduced output, and consumer welfare loss. So it's not good for us when that happens. Marginal cost on a graph. So marginal cost, remember, that is just extra cost, and it's incurred by producing one more unit of output. On a graph, it's represented by the slope of the total cost curve. So on the test, pretty sure it'll be a marginal cost graph question, where you'll have to look and probably interpret the graph a little bit. Actually, now that I think about it, the marginal cost, the average total cost, and the marginal revenue, all those things go on the same graph. So you're going to see all these on the same graph, and you're going to have to read and interpret it. So I had it in my notes, and then I didn't read far enough. So the marginal cost, that's the marginal, the extra cost of producing that other unit. The average total cost is the total cost per unit of output calculated by dividing total cost by the quantity produced. Now, for this question, you're not going to have to know the math of it. I think you have to do some math a little bit later. That's why you should have a basic calculator. But it's going to be where you it's the total cost by the quantity produced, and it's going to be on the graph. Sorry, I don't have a visual But you should be able to take a look and see what's going on with marginal cost, average total cost, and then finally marginal revenue on the graph, because they're all in the same one. Marginal revenue is the additional revenue generated by producing one more unit. So that marginal part is the extra revenue from producing one more unit. And hopefully we remember and know that all this stuff kind of goes together. If I'm going to incur one more cost, I need to know what my one more revenue is going to be and things like that. All right, moving on to unit five, marginal factor cost, MFC, and marginal revenue product when hiring more workers. So the MFC, that's the additional cost incurred by hiring one more unit of a factor of production, such as labor in this example. And then the marginal revenue product is the additional revenue generated by employing that extra labor. Firms in the market, the perfectly competitive market, labor market, will hire workers up to the point where the MRP, the marginal revenue product, equals the MFC to maximize profit. Once we get over or under those things, that's when the firms are going to have to start deciding kind of what they're doing. But that's what goes into hiring more workers, is we got to try and get to MRP equals MFC in this situation. Perfectly competitive market, profits in hiring one more worker. So in the perfectly competitive labor market, firms are price takers and have to pay the market wage rate. Profits are maximized when the marginal revenue product of labor equals the wage rate. And so hiring one more worker will increase total output and revenue if the marginal revenue product of labor exceeds the wage rate. So when you see this question, that's what you're going to be thinking about. Is that wage rate exceeding the marginal revenue product? Wage rates among different professions. I think you've seen this question before. I think it's the accountant and maybe the educators, if I remember the question correctly. But wage rates vary about from different professions. I think this is pretty simple to understand. And a lot of things go into it. skill level, the education taken, the demand, you know, labor market conditions, and typically professions that require more specialized skills are going to get higher wage rates than others because of scarcity and the fact there's not so many people that can do that job. And so you've got to take all that into account. And there's, I think it's a scenario on the test. All right, the marginal revenue product we just talked about, so not going to talk about it too much again here, but that's that extra revenue generated by one more unit of a factor production. And in the perfectly competitive market, MRP equals the marginal product of the factor multiplied by the price of the output. Effects of an aging population. So aging populations have a couple of different things going on. First off, it leads to changes in the labor force participation as people age out of the workforce. Productivity, it's just a fact. It's just a fact of life. Basically, people slow down as they get older and they can't produce as much. Consumption patterns, government spending on healthcare and pensions, as people age out, those things are going to go up as the government has to spend more, to keep people well. And also as they have to play government pensions, not everybody has a government pension, but, you know, as people that have been working for the government get their pension, that's going to in turn go up. There can also be labor shortages in certain industries, as people, a whole bunch of people retire, get too old to work, whatever it might be, then you got to bring in new people to replace them. And so that could, increase demand for workers and things like that. Perfectly competitive product and factor markets, prices increase, decrease. So a long topic here. In a perfectly competitive market, prices are determined by supply and demand. All right. So that's one of the key things to remember back from what we just talked about a little bit ago, in that that's the driving force. Okay. It's not me. It's not you. It is the supply and demand of our product. If there's an increase in demand for a product, its price will increase, leading to higher revenues for the firms, and then vice versa if it decreases, the demand decreases. In factor markets such as the labor market, an increase in demand for labor will lead to higher wage rates. So if there's more of a need for us in our job, then we in turn should get higher wages. Inputs in a perfectly competitive market. So inputs in a perfectly competitive market refer to factors of production such as labor, capital, land, and all those things that go into running a firm that are bought and sold by firms. Firms are going to try and maximize their output, their profit, excuse me, by employing a combination of inputs that minimize the cost of production for a given level of output. So that's the key thing to take away from this thing here, and the inputs in a perfectly competitive market. Firms looking to maximize their profit are going to do what they need to get the combination of inputs that minimize the cost of production, and they can make as much money as possible. The shift the demand curve for a factor of production. So factors that can shift the demand curve for this include changes in the price of the final product, changes in technology, changes in the prices of other factors of production, and changes in consumer preferences. So all those things can lead to demand changing on this curve. So let's say changes in technology. Let's say there's an increase in technology, then that probably would increase demand. If there's some kind of breakdown of technology, that will probably lead to a decrease in demand. So just the different components of our changes in demand. Monopolistic labor market. So in this market, there's only one buyer of labor, and it's where there's a single firm or employer. So think about like you're a super small town and there's one gas station there. They're the only ones hiring, for that gas station. You can't go to the next door to another gas station. That's the only one. So that's kind of what we're talking about here. In this labor market, the employer has market power to set the wage rate below the competitive level, leading to lower wages and employment than in a perfectly competitive market. Because once again, they don't have to worry about keeping you happy. Okay, they can hire you. They can hire you the wage they want to for the most part because you don't have any options. You can't go anywhere else. Binding minimum wage in a perfectly competitive labor market. So in a perfectly competitive labor market, a binding minimum wage set above the equilibrium wage rate will lead to unemployment as firms reduce the quantity of labor demanded. The minimum wage can distort labor market outcomes and lead to inefficiencies if it exceeds the market clearing wage rate. So basically, if a binding minimum wage is set above the market clearing wage rate, that's going to lead to problems and issues for the the firms in that market. All right. Lastly, six, the recent stuff. First up is socially optimal. So this occurs when resources are allocated in a way that maximizes total societal welfare. In the absence of market failures, competitive markets lead to socially optimal outcomes where marginal social cost equals marginal social benefit. So this is one of the first things we talked about, or it was one of the first PowerPoints and PowerPoint videos that we had where we are looking for that socially optimal level. Dealing with a natural monopoly. So a natural monopoly occurs when economies of scale allow one firm to serve the entire market at the regular cost. Regulation. Price controls, think of price ceilings, price floors, those things, public ownership are common approaches to addressing the inefficiencies associated with natural monopolies. So basically, like I think I said this earlier, the government typically has to step in and be the competition with a natural monopoly. And so a lot of times the government will try and work with the natural monopoly to make sure that everything's running smoothly and fairly for consumers. Antitrust legislation. So that aims to promote competition and prevent monopolistic practices that harm consumer welfare. so basically any law that prohibits price fixing, collusion, market allocation, any of that stuff is going to be considered antitrust legislation. It was big in the 1900s. Teddy Roosevelt, president in the United States, he was a big trust buster. And so he wrote, that was his thing, was to make sure there was no trust out there. Market transactions, that refers to the exchange of goods and services between buyers and sellers in a market economy. Efficient markets require well-defined property rights, enforcement of contracts, and information transparency. Basically, market transactions are just those, the buying and selling. Price floors and price ceilings. Price floors set a minimum price for a good or service above the equilibrium price, leading to surpluses. Price ceilings set a maximum price below the equilibrium price, leading to shortages. So basically in these, the government is intervening. The government has stepped in and they think something is happening and they need to try and set prices. Like it says, the price floor is a minimum price above the equilibrium price. So let's say equilibrium price is $5 and the government's like, well, that's too low. Let's raise that up to $7. That's the new price floor. Price ceilings are below the equilibrium price. So, hey, equilibrium price is $500, but that is too much. Let's drop it to $250. All righty. And it leads to the surpluses and shortages. Price floors are short surpluses. Price ceilings are shortages. So on a graph, just remember the price floors are above equilibrium. Price ceilings are going to be below. So it looks kind of different. It looks, a lot of people will look at this and want to say, hey, the price ceiling should be above the equilibrium because it's, you know, that's the ceiling. And then the price floor should be below because that's the floor, but it's the opposite. The Gini coefficient, so that's a measure of income inequality with a population ranging from 0 to 1. I'm pretty sure there's a map on the test that you have to take a look at. The higher Gini coefficients indicate greater income inequality. Positive and negative externalities. So positive externalities occur when the social benefits of a good exceed the private benefits, leading to underproduction. Negative externalities occur when the social costs of a good exceed the private costs, leading to overproduction. Government intervention like taxes or subsidies can internalize externalities and improve efficiency. The bottom line here is to remember externalities. Those are those extra things that happen when an economic decision is made. All right. So I think in the video, I used the example of an airport. So if an airport gets built, that's good in that it produces jobs. It'll produce, you know, people getting air travel that's closer to them and things like that. But if it's built right next to my house, well, that's a problem because that's going to have planes flying over my house at all hours of night. And I don't really want that. So that'd be a negative externality for me. The Lorenz curve is a graphical representation of income distribution within a population. It plots the cumulative share of income received by the bottom percentage of households against the cumulative share of the population. And so, you know, there was the PowerPoint that had this, and it shows you the income distribution. I think one of them compared to countries, maybe. But that's what you're looking at when you see this is basically income distribution in country A versus income distribution in country B. You can also look at it and just see, okay, that's what it looks like within that population. So there's a couple of different uses for it. Public and private goods. So public goods are non-excludable and non-rivalrous, meaning consumption by one individual does not reduce the availability to others. Remember, like roads are going to be public goods. They can't stop me from using the road. Private goods are excludable and rivalrous, meaning they can be consumed exclusively by those who pay for them. Lump sum taxes, per unit taxes, and subsidies. So lump sum, that's a fixed tax, you know, on the product versus the per unit, which is, you know, if you produce 10 units, then you pay this many taxes. So if you want to reduce them, you just produce less units. The subsidy, remember, that's the government paying basically to do or not do something. Marginal social costs, private cost, and social benefit. So MSC represents the additional cost imposed on society by producing one more unit of a good. So we're thinking kind of outside of the firm and just in the society. MPC represents the additional cost incurred by the producer. So that's producer only. And then MSB, social benefit, represents the additional benefit received by society from consuming one more unit of a good. And so when you see this, those are the things that you're thinking of. Ways to reduce income inequality. Policies to reduce income inequality include the taxation. Remember, we had the three types, progressive, regressive, and proportional. Progressive taxation is a way to try and reduce inequality because that's as you make more money, you pay more in the form of taxes. Transfer payments, that's paying like think welfare and other payments like that. Education and training programs, minimum wage laws, and social welfare programs. All right, going to take a quick break and come back and go over the FRQs.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
All right, welcome back. So you have two FRQs, and I tried to be as descriptive as possible on what you're going to be doing. Or at least the topics, not necessarily what you're going to do, but the topics. And so the topics that are listed are the topics you need to know. So let's go through those. So for the first one, you got to know total revenue. And that's the amount of money received by a firm from selling a given quantity of a good or service. And you calculate it, and you'll have to be able to calculate it on the FRQ. So multiplying the price per unit by the quantity sold, and it's expressed as TR equals P times Q. And on the test, you'll have to be able to, that's part of the thing you're gonna have to take a picture of and show. The allocatively efficient, that occurs when resources are allocated in a way that maximizes total social welfare. In the perfectly competitive market, allocative efficiency is achieved when marginal cost equals marginal benefit, ensuring that resources are allocated to their highest valued uses. Marginal cost curve and the average total cost. So the curve shows the additional cost incurred by producing one more unit of output. So when you're looking at that, just keep that in mind. Hey, this is what it looks like if they're producing that one extra unit. The average total cost curve shows the average cost per unit of output and is calculated by dividing total cost by the quantity produced. Typically, the marginal cost curve intersects the average total cost curve at its lowest point, representing the minimum point of the average total cost curve, where MC equals ATC. Calculate the consumer surplus. So consumer surplus measures the difference between what consumers are willing to pay for a good and what they actually pay. To calculate this, you need the demand curve for the good, which represents consumers' willingness to pay at various levels. Consumer surplus is the area between the demand curve and the price level paid by consumers for the quantity of the good purchased. And you calculate the consumer surplus as the area of the triangle formed by the price level, the quantity, and the demand curve. Okay, so I went kind of quick through that. So just once again, you calculate the consumer surplus is the area of the triangle when you get your, you should have the graph, I think, of the triangle formed by the price level, the quantity, and the demand curve. Alrighty. And when it says to show your work, it's showing the math, it's showing graphs that you might have to do, and whatever else it's requiring you to show. Okay. So just to be sure, like you would do your demand curve, which is going to show the consumer's willingness. On it, you're going to identify the equilibrium price and quantity. So that's where demand equals supply. Then you draw the horizontal line from the equilibrium quantity to the demand curve to determine the highest price consumers are willing to pay. You calculate the area of that triangle by the equilibrium quantity, the demand curve, and the price level, which we already said. And then you would just kind of write out, hey, this is what I did, and this is how I showed it. All right. And if you need to include the formula for consumer surplus, that might be good too. All right. FRQ 2, you got wages, shortages, and surplus first off. So wages in a labor market are determined by the intersection of the demand for labor and the supply of labor. All right. So that's where we figure out what's going to be the wages here. If the wage rate is below the equilibrium wage, there will be a shortage of labor as the quantity demanded exceeds the quantity supplied. So once again, if the wage rate is below the equilibrium wage, whatever that might be, there's going to be a shortage of labor as quantity demanded is more than the quantity supplied. If the wage rate is above the equilibrium wage, there's going to be a surplus. Basically, we get down to the fact, do people want to work or not for this price? And people deciding, okay, if the price goes up, then I'll work. If the price goes down, I won't work, so on and so forth. To show your work here, you would graph the demand and supply curves for labor, identify the equilibrium wage and quantity, and determine whether there's a shortage or surplus by comparing the quantity demanded and supplied. So basically on your graph, you should be able to show, hey, here's a surplus, here's a short. I'm sorry if you hear my dogs. This is the fifth review I've done, and they have not barked yet until now. Profit maximizing labor. Firms hire labor up to the point where the marginal revenue product of labor equals the wage rate. MPR represents the additional revenue generated by hiring one more unit of labor. So I'm doing this at 10 units of labor. What if I hire one more? And that's what this is getting at. And then we figure out the wage rate from there. To maximize profit, firms will continue to hire labor until MRP equals the wage rate, ensuring that the marginal cost of hiring labor equals the marginal revenue generated by labor. Profit maximizing wages. So profit maximizing wages occur when firms pay workers the value of their marginal product of labor. If firms pay wages below the value of the marginal product of labor, they earn higher profits. So if they can get away with that, that's what they want to do. If firms pay wages above the marginal product of labor, they experience reduced profits or even losses. They don't want to do that. Marginal product increases in decreases. So marginal product measures the additional output produced by hiring one more unit of labor, holding other inputs constant. Marginal product initially increases as more labor is hired, reflecting increasing returns to labor. However, marginal product eventually decreases as the law of diminishing marginal returns sets in, causing each additional unit of labor to contribute less to total output. So basically here, at some point you run into a situation where this person is not doing anything. When I was in college, I worked in an office, working my way through college, and I was the fourth person in a third person office. I really was not a necessary component of that office. And I got moved around eventually because they realized, okay, he's here, he's getting paid, but he's not contributing to the office that much. Now, it wasn't my fault. I did what I was asked to do, but they just overhired for the position, for the office. And then finally, marginal analysis that involves comparing the marginal cost and the marginal benefit of a decision to determine the optimal level of activity. In the context of labor markets, firms use marginal analysis to determine how many workers to hire. Okay, that is the review. If you have questions this week, I don't know when you're going to take your test. If you have it, if you have questions before you take it, please just reach out and let me know. And just once again, have a calculator, have a piece of paper, have a pen or pencil, and you or your proctor, take a picture and send me the work once you're done and I'll get it graded. I have enjoyed having you in class. I know we haven't got to interact as much as I would like to, but I think we made it work. I appreciate you. I think you are an excellent student, and you're going to do great things. I'm not sure what grade you're in, but if you are graduating and going off to college, I wish you the best luck there. I am sure you're going to find success. If you are not graduating yet and you still have some more time left, just keep on going. You will get to there and get to college. And once again, whenever you get there, I know you're going to do good things. So best of luck. If I can ever help you, and I don't know what I can do, but if I can ever help you, just please feel free to reach out. My email will not change. All right, take care and bye-bye.